Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast.
We've seen a very meaningful increase in gas prices.
Commodity prices have moved up significantly. Energy prices in particular. We're going to see upward pressure on inflation, at least for a while. We don't know how long that will be sustained for.
I'm going to do everything I can to minimize Putin's price hike here at home. The price of the gas at the pump in America went up 75 cents. And with this action, it's going to go up further.
Prices will go up, but it won't actually affect ongoing inflation. That's really the key thing.
Now, on to the show.
Red Alert. This is the most important podcast you may ever listen to in your entire life.
My guess is that next month we'll see further evidence of an impact on U.S. inflation of Putin's war on Ukraine.
So you're prepared to do what it takes to protect price stability?
Yes.
That would be a departure of what you've done.
Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is Todd Zempel, and with me, Joe Gordon. Today on the podcast, we invited a very special guest, Brad Olson. Brad Olson is co-founding partner and portfolio manager at Recurrent Advisors. Now, we wanted to invite you on to the podcast to share your insight on what's going on in the energy space. You are uniquely qualified to speak on this. So why don't I just turn over the reins and let you take it from here?
Yeah, that sounds great. So I guess to kick it off, 5 years ago, Mark Laskin, my partner, who I know you all have met, Mark and I founded Recurrent Investment Advisors. We're an RIA here in Houston. We manage a mutual fund. We manage about $350 million today. Prior to launching Recurrent, Mark and I were the two lead portfolio managers for Boone Pickens BP Capital in Dallas, where we manage two generally identical strategies. So, you know, all we've done is energy and pipelines for, you know, really better part of a couple decades now. And, you know, we live, breathe, speak energy. And it just so happens that I studied abroad in Russia when I was in college. So, a lot of things going on today that are relevant to what we do.
Well, speaking of Russia, let's go ahead and go right there. What are your thoughts on the situation that's unfolding over in Russia and Ukraine right now?
Yeah, you bet. So obviously, Russia's history, Russia and previously, you know, the Soviet Union has a complex history that's way beyond the scope of our discussion. So I'd like to offer maybe a personal anecdote from my time living abroad in St. Petersburg. I actually lived with a Russian family, and this is 20 years ago now, but the woman I lived with was in her 50s, and I was looking for something to do for my spring break, looking for somewhere to go in Eastern Europe. And I said, you know, Irina, do you have any ideas on where I should fly to? And she said, yeah, you should go down to the Crimea. It's the finest beach in all of Russia. And I said, well, you know, Irina, I can't because I don't have a visa to visit the Ukraine. I actually only have a visa for Russia. And she looked at me really confused. And she said, that's impossible. Crimea has always been a part of Russia. We conquered it from the Turks in the 1700s. You can go there. If you can go to St. Petersburg, you can go to the Crimea. And I felt really weird because obviously, you know, that just wasn't the case. And in a kind of moment of nervousness, I grabbed the Russian yellow pages off the shelf and I pointed to the map that showed the country codes and the area codes. And sure enough, there's Crimea in Ukraine with the Ukrainian country code. And she looked at me with this devastated look on her face and said, Brad, when did Russia give everything away? We used to be a great power. And I thought to myself, man, this is way deeper than my spring break planning was supposed to be. But it gives you an idea that in Russia, there is a deep sense of areas that have Russian speakers and that used to be part of the Soviet Union were unjustly separated from Russia, from the motherland. And so when Westerners kind of view this as a hearkening back to World War II or a level of, you know, military violence not seen in 80 years, you know, Russia views it as in a lot of ways fixing a historical injustice that they suffered without anyone taking a vote, without anybody really asking their opinion. So I think when understanding Russia, you know, there's a different perspective that's influenced by their historical experience. But that being said, I think many in Russia who thought that seizing Crimea made a lot of sense now have some real misgivings about how widespread the invasion of Ukraine has gotten. And it's going to be, I think, the rest of Putin's natural life. This is going to be a problem that he's created that has, you know, permanently changed commodity, oil and gas markets, wheat markets, you name it. And so we're going to be spending years, not weeks or months, dealing with the outcomes of his decision.
So big picture, Brad, what is it Recurrent feels is the current outlook for energy prices, whether oil or natural gas, given this whole overlay of the Russia-Ukraine situation?
Look, one thing that I'd say is, especially right now where it feels like American politicians are somewhat illiterate on energy security and energy politics, you know, Vladimir Putin waited until he had grown his market share of the European gas market from about 25% to 50% of the European gas market in the last 10 years. And now with 50% of the European gas market, he attacked Ukraine thinking that Europe was kind of trapped, and they are kind of trapped in terms of gas. But from a big picture perspective, you know, Russia provides about 10% of the world's oil. They also provide about 50% of Europe's gas. So Russia's a meaningful producer. And our outlook for energy and commodity markets is somewhat similar to the Arab oil embargo of 1973, where a hostile country basically decided to cut off or meaningfully disrupt the supply of commodities to the Western world. And if you ask me for my opinion, I think for the rest of Vladimir Putin's rule or the rest of his natural life, those are probably the same thing, in my opinion. You know, commodity prices will be high and oil will likely be above 100 until somebody else is in charge of Russia.
So do you, from where you sit again with the energy perspective, what do you make of some of the narrative out there that Putin has terminal cancer and that this is his last hurrah, his legacy, you know, that kind of thing? Is that something that's floating around in the energy circles?
You know, I think the reality is, if you look at the history of the region and if you look at the energy market in particular, Russia has always had a belief that any Russian leader who basically dies with a potential invader on their borders, anybody who cedes Russian territory really shouldn't be remembered as a great Russian leader. And there's no question to me that even without a cancer diagnosis or without anything personally specific to Putin, Putin is about to turn 70. He is at the peak of his negotiating leverage because energy prices are high again. And if you look at the last 50 years of Russian foreign policy, Russia invades, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Georgia, and now Ukraine, Russia invades countries when oil and gas prices are high. So I don't think you need a big cancer diagnosis or a conspiracy theory to explain that Putin wants to die with more Russian territory under control than less. He views Ukraine as kind of the one big unsettled question on Russian borders. And he now has more oil and gas revenues coming in every month than he's had in the better part of several decades.
Yeah. So what do you make of the narrative from the White House and others in the administration that you need to go buy an electric vehicle that'll solve your problems versus the issue of just let us produce more here? We were energy independent when Trump left the office, and now we're energy dependent again.
Yeah, look, I think that you hit on a very important point, which is getting energy independent from the year 2005 to the year 2020 or 2019. The United States did something completely unprecedented. We went from importing 12 million barrels a day of oil and petroleum products to importing effectively a net zero or even a slight net exporter of oil over that 15-year period. That is truly unprecedented in history. I think when you look at the electric vehicle narrative, one of the things we're really proud of is in 2017, we highlighted, before people really caught on to all the impacts of electric vehicles, that the batteries that electric vehicles rely on come from countries that are in every way governed more brutally and are less ESG friendly than the countries that produce oil. For example, batteries require nickel. Tesla batteries require nickel. 20% of the world's nickel comes from Russia. All sorts of metals and mine products come from Russia that are essential to making electric vehicles. So the reality is, when you're talking about the energy transition and getting off of oil, not only is it debatable that you're still on the electric grid with an electric vehicle, you're still relying on natural gas powered electricity, but I'd say this is a really important point. When you choose an electric vehicle, you might consume less gasoline, but you are effectively finding yourself reliant on a battery technology, which is more dependent on dictatorships in Africa, Russia, and China than even the oil market, which is something that I don't think gets discussed enough.
Yeah, so let's go back. One of the white papers you posted, I think about a year and a half ago now, about your analogy of the future prospects of oil and gas being akin to what happened to big tobacco in the 90s.
Yeah, it's a parallel we talk about a lot, which is, you know, the oil and gas sector, we just talked about going from an importer of 12 million barrels a day to effectively backing out all those imports. It took a huge amount of capital spending. The average oil and gas company in America was investing more even than it had in cash flow for much of the last decade and a half. Now, with our oil production significantly higher than it was over the last few decades, we are now in much more of a maintenance mode, if you will. The same way that after the 1999 Department of Justice lawsuit against Big Tobacco, the tobacco industry moved out of a growth mode and an advertising mode into a maintenance mode with huge cash flow and really not a whole lot of growth initiatives to spend that cash flow on. We liken really not just the oil and gas sector, but very specifically the pipeline sector, where the government has said they're not going to let you build Keystone. They're not going to let you build pipelines to effectively let us make the best use of the oil and gas we produce. And in the absence of being allowed to expand the oil and gas industry, much like the tobacco industry, the oil and gas industry has a 12 to 15% gross cash flow yield to offer to investors. And if there's no allowable opportunities to grow and to reinvest that cash flow, it means that your dividends, your share buybacks are going to really approach what the tobacco industry saw over the last two decades, which is, you know, kind of a double digit cash flow yield back to investors, because there aren't really a lot of growth initiatives to invest in.
Tell us about how you source your investment ideas then, especially in the pipeline business, because it doesn't seem like there'll be any new competitors because of the government stance. And also, it's very difficult to raise capital. I even saw, I think it was last week or the week before, Blackstone announced they would no longer do any financing in the energy patch in the U.S.
Yeah, we've seen, I think, a lot of, frankly, short-sighted initiatives. And, you know, only in the last few days, we've seen a lot of the ESG funds that were so public about divesting from North American oil and gas, which, of course, is one of, you know, the highest ethical standards of any oil and gas industry anywhere. You know, the same funds that invest in oil and gas or don't invest in oil and gas were, in some cases, heavily invested in low carbon technologies in Russia. And so we're starting to find out that the ESG definition was maybe insufficient for tackling some of the real problems in going on in the world today. But, you know, your kind of broader question, in a world where you can't get money to grow and you can't get money for new projects, you're kind of just a monopoly that is effectively not growing, but has huge market power because there are no new competitors entering the space. And so when we're screening for investments in our energy fund, one thing we are looking for is the two biggest consumables in the oil and gas industry are labor and steel. And when you think about the oil and gas industry, a well-managed company is going to benefit from higher oil and gas prices. But even a low growth industry needs to be thoughtful about its labor costs and its steel inputs and raw materials. And so over time, we're looking for companies that have done the best job limiting costs, fighting inflation in their own cost structures while capturing as much of that commodity upside as possible, as reflected in their returns on capital. And then the one other point I'd make is these assets are very difficult to build from a regulatory perspective. It's impossible to build a new pipe today. We're looking for assets where we can effectively acquire these assets that have been discarded by Blackstone or BlackRock or whoever's ESG mandate. If these assets are available on public markets at a discount to the steel value, the value of construction, and we can get these companies that have a proven track record of generating high returns, and we can buy them at a discount to book value, we view that as being, you know, one of the unique opportunities in the market today.
Yeah, so let me ask you about price impact on your security selection and fund performance. To what extent do you and Mark look at, well, gee, what are our prospects here if oil is $120 a barrel versus if it's $60 a barrel? Because that's sort of kind of the last 12 months, I think, or 12 to 18 months, we've got that range. So how much is the sensitivity of the price of the commodity, oil or natural gas, affected in how you select securities?
You know, believe it or not, oil and gas prices, for especially for the pipeline securities we follow, you know, really are about 20% of the overall cash flow. So most of what you're going to earn as an infrastructure company focused on oil and gas will be, you know, a standard fixed fee tariff for the use of your pipeline. And the oil and gas upside comes from the fact that transferring cash or posting collateral and letters of credit, especially for small oil and gas producers, is a hassle. And so pipeline companies historically for their smaller customers have said, how about this? You don't have to pay me in cash, but I am going to effectively siphon 5% of whatever volume you send through my pipeline. And that is going to be my effective paid in kind fee. And so there is some benefit from a higher oil and gas price, because there are some revenues that are received in the form of barrels and units of gas that have to be sold on the open market. So pipelines have a nice combination of a very stable base cash flow with the ability to capture the upside from price spikes. But, you know, Joe, your bigger question, I think there's an interesting answer here. Historically, pipeline total returns have actually been just as strong when oil prices are at 50 than as when they've been $100. And the reason for that really is $100 oil can increase profitability of pipeline companies. But as we know, $100 oil gets bankers more interested in lending to pipelines, and it gets investors more interested in energy investments. So there have been times when $100 oil has, I would say, led some of these companies astray, where some of these companies historically took on big debt loads because they felt confident in the ongoing $100 oil price. And when oil fell from 100 down to 50 back in 2015, some of these companies were forced to go on debt reduction programs in order to earn back their investment grade credit rating. So one of the things that gets us really excited about the setup today is 2020 COVID effectively forced the entire industry into a radical debt reduction program. So the debt is as low as it's ever been. And now you're getting that commodity upside, which again can increase the earnings of these companies 20-30%. But you also have a balance sheet that is so clean that all of that incremental profitability is going to come back to a shareholder in the form of a dividend or a stock buyback.
So then would it be fair to say that when you guys look at what you're going to invest in the fund, you put a big emphasis on the balance sheet and the debt levels? You know, one of the things I've always kind of looked at the energy patch was that there was a lot of wildcat speculators. And obviously, when you have wild price swings, the leveraged ones go out of business. And it wasn't too unlike gold miners back in 2011 when the price for gold for the first time went north of $1,900 an ounce. They basically were no better than just land speculators trying to buy all the land they could. And they were very reckless in their balance sheet and capital deployment capabilities, just crazy, wild. And then they paid for it. So in a similar way, it sounds like you're saying the same kind of thing. There was no capital allocation discipline because the price was high. Everybody assumed it was going to stay higher, go higher in 2014. And then we had the collapse. And I think the price went back below 30, peak to trough. And yep. now we have the whole new horizon. So what do you have to say to that?
Yeah, Joe, I think the gold miner analog is a great one. I mean, it's a perfect historical analogy. You know, when I came into the energy investing business, almost every single CEO's bonus structure was set by how much oil production growth they achieved versus the previous year. That with the wash of financial distress during COVID, now today your average CEO is getting paid on how much earnings per share growth or how much, you know, a different present value per share he's creating. And the reality, of course, is that it's much easier to create value spending judiciously, spending 20% of your cash flow, whereas spending 300% of your cash flow, things get out of control and kind of turns into that speculation mindset that you just highlighted.
So even in the energy sector, there's been a major reformation of how CEOs are compensated to better align their incentives with those of shareholders.
That's exactly right. And one of the things I think that if we were to list, you know, oil and gas prices skyrocketing, obviously is almost just been here for a month. But before the last month, we would tell folks that the reality is when you look at all the dividend growth and our portfolio experienced over 10% dividend growth last quarter alone. And when people say, wow, is that because of higher oil prices? It's actually about 20% higher profitability, but it's 80% from less capital leaving the building, less dollars going out the door in terms of capital reinvestment. So the capital discipline is actually where your bread is being buttered right now as a shareholder, as opposed to, you know, some sort of windfall profit, which, you know, again, hasn't even been here for that long.
So just to conclude about a specific CEO activity you see, what is the thought process right now with a lot of the companies you look at as far as accelerating any production at the urgence of the White House? Trying to say that the problem is a lot of the energy companies don't want to invest more CapEx. What would be your comment to that?
You know, ironically, I think there's obviously a lot of misunderstanding about the energy industry in the mainstream media. And one of the things that I think is poorly understood is how little in terms of tax credits and tax breaks conventional energy gets in the United States. And so you had this strategic asset. We became an energy exporter over the last, you know, several years before COVID. And the government basically watched as the industry went from running 2,000 rigs to experiencing acute financial distress. We today, with oil prices making 10-year highs, we're only back to 600 rigs. So with the amount of drilling we're doing in this country is down 60 or 70%. There have been no financial incentives extended. Yesterday, you saw Elizabeth Warren suggest that there should be a windfall profits tax, which would, of course, further reduce the capital available for drilling. And you've obviously only recently seen major regulatory hurdles get in the way of LNG export infrastructure, pipeline infrastructure. And early in Biden's tenure, you saw basically a moratorium on federal land drilling. And you've even recently seen Gulf of Mexico leases get torn up by judges or the government. So there's no doubt that if you are a CEO, you went through a period of distress during COVID, you received no help from the government, you laid off 50, in some cases, 75% of your employees, the amount of workforce available in the oil field has never been lower. And then because of some of the other issues, steel mills can't get enough natural gas, can't get enough coal. you now have the situation where your two biggest consumables, labor and steel, as I mentioned earlier, are now much more expensive than really any time in the last 10 years. So your oil and gas CEO is saying, you've made my life harder. You haven't extended me any help. Because of some of these policies, I'm paying 50% more for labor. I'm paying 50% more for steel pipe. And I'm not excited about accelerating because, again, I'm a CEO. My incentives change to encourage me to maximize earnings per share. If I go out and start drilling willy-nilly with no financial support, I'm going to be paying a lot more to drill each well. Each well is going to be less profitable, and it might not even be accretive to my current earnings per share, which is only getting higher because of some of the mismanagement of energy security. And so I think CEOs are rightly saying, you've shown me a lot of red, you haven't shown me a lot of green, and now that you're in a tough spot, after you've offered to take Venezuela off sanctions, you've told me it would be nice if I could drill too, with no economic or financial incentives. And I think, you know, CEOs are right to say, until we hear dramatically different messaging out of Washington, I'd rather pay myself a giant special dividend out of this excess profitability than invest in wells that are 100% more expensive than they were a year or two ago.
So there's a famous betting game, poker game called Texas Hold'em. And what do you and Mark look for when it's time to play Texas Fold'em or energy name Fold'em? Because everything sounds so good, regardless of the price. You know, what is your sell discipline?
Yeah, so the sell discipline is, generally speaking, in a capitalist economy, a great party will always kind of sow the seeds of its own demise, right? You know, eventually the party gets to a point where the cops get called. And I think when you look at what was the last down cycle in energy, oil prices were 100, and some people say, oh, oil prices are at 100, this can't last, I'm getting out. But the reason we saw sustained $100 pricing is because the world didn't have a lot of new options for energy supply. And of course, the US found shale. Shale attracted hundreds of billions of dollars of capital. And ultimately, when you get to a point where energy companies are investing more than they're bringing in a bull market, that's when Wall Street is at its peak excitement level. And that's usually when it's time to leave the party. And one of the things that we see today is it is a unique situation because energy is increasingly important to the economy, and it's never been a smaller percentage of American investor allocation. So it used to be 15% of the S&P 500. Today, it's 3% of the S&P 500, despite the fact that oil prices are at decade highs. So what are Mark and I looking for when it's time to kind of say, we've had a good run, time to move into something much more safe? Well, we need to actually see a supply response. One of the things I mentioned earlier is when we're running 2,000 rigs in the United States, that means that the bull market has a ticking clock that has an expiration date on it. Today, with oil prices surging, with all the obstacles I highlighted a minute ago, drilling activity is still 70% lower than it should be given where oil prices are because all of the political and regulatory obstacles we mentioned. And so, you know, one of the things that Mark and I look at each other and kind of, I won't say pinch ourselves, but we say, at any time in history when oil price is at 100 on an inflation adjusted basis, going back 50 or 60 years, the oil and gas industry was spending like a drunken sailor and working overtime to find more barrels. This is the only time in history in the last, you know, really 50, probably 100 years where oil prices are making decade highs and rig count and new investment is not budging because of folks like BlackRock and Blackstone saying that we don't have to pay attention to oil price. We should just double down on renewables and electric vehicles. So when that drilling level ramps up and the level of reinvestment, again, goes from 20 to 30% reinvestment of cash flow back to 100 or 200% of cash flow being reinvested, that tends to be the time when we're going to get a lot more defensive. But before that happens, you need to see Wall Street, you know, you need to see valuations for these companies get high enough that companies feel emboldened to spend. And a lot of these companies look at their valuation and they say, you know, I'm trading at 3x cash flow or 4x cash flow. Wall Street is not giving me a green light to reinvest in my business. So I'm going to sit tight and just keep paying big special dividends for the foreseeable future.
Very good. So I noticed in your top 10 holdings, you own a couple major refiners, Valero and Marathon Petroleum. What makes those type investments attractive to the fund and to your style?
Yeah. So one of the things that over a decade or multi-decade, looking at the energy space, one thing that surprises folks who aren't as familiar with the energy industry is you'll see a lot of companies that have a lot of oil exposure who still struggle to generate earnings per share growth over time. One of the reasons for that is a typical oil and gas company might have an actuarial life, a non-pipeline company might have an actuarial life of 5 years, meaning that every year you have to replace a fifth of your assets. In a hugely inflationary environment, you want to spend as little as possible until prices calm down. One of the things we like about refiners is your actuarial life is 30 or 40 years. Typically, you're only reinvesting, a few percent of your capital base to keep those assets maintained and running well. Another thing is pipelines are the regulatory kind of target today. Historically, we haven't really built a new major refinery here in the United States in 50 years because it's hard to get a refinery permitted anywhere that people live. And so we've just basically had a monopolistic industry that gets expanded bit by bit, but never really see any new assets built. So what we like about refining is it's a domestic industry that benefits from the fact that America has dramatically lower energy costs than Europe, and I think probably will until the end of Vladimir Putin's reign, if not longer. America is a low-cost energy leader. Refineries are really monopolistic or oligopolistic assets that can take that low-cost gas and that low-cost oil, use it to produce gasoline and diesel, and export it to much more energy constrained markets like Latin America or Europe. And even as inflation ticks up, refining industry doesn't have to pay. It's not as labor intensive and it's not as steel intensive as actually, wildcatting and drilling a well out in the field.
Yeah, so Germany is often brought up as the poster child for going all in on green energy gone wrong. And they're at center stage now because of the information, not just the Russia-Ukraine issue. And they do have a new chancellor who's going in a different direction than Merkel because he pretty much has to since they're so dependent on Russia. But also people in Germany pay 5x what Americans pay for natural gas. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the green movement, especially as it's manifested itself in Germany, took root for a variety of reasons. One thing is, as somebody with a Russian studies background, Vladimir Putin has steadily financed both right-wing parties as well as green parties all across Europe, with the general thought being that if I can get wedge parties and extreme parties to shut down nukes, my gas is the permanent replacement for those nukes, because Vladimir Putin understands that you cannot replace a natural gas plant that runs throughout the winter and during days when there's no sun and no wind. You can't replace that with renewables. And so, I think when you look at Germany, a couple factors. European energy costs had fallen pretty dramatically as the U.S. went from an importer of gas to an exporter of gas. Gazprom had its first international competition in a long time. They offered huge discounts to Germany in exchange with signing a contract for Nord Stream. As Putin saw his market share of the German gas market go up, he knew that he had a chance to be more aggressive militarily and that Germany didn't really have a lot of other options because they've made themselves beholden to, solar and wind. And the reality, which doesn't get discussed and is never brought up in the mainstream media because it's complicated and it's hard to explain simply, is that for every gigawatt of gas or nuke power you take offline, you have to replace it with multiple gigawatts of solar and wind, because solar in Germany runs about 20% of the time, only in the middle of the day. Wind power generally only works 30 to 40% of the time, depending on how good of a wind resource you're located in. So not only is wind and solar intermittent and unreliable, but you have to replace a nuclear plant with multiple gigawatts of solar and wind. And solar and wind on a gigawatt to gigawatt basis is slightly more expensive than a nuke or than natural gas. But the fact that you have to replace every gigawatt of natural gas or coal or nukes with multiple gigawatts of wind and solar goes back to the point you just made, which is you end up paying 3 to 5 times more. And the only reason the German population was willing to tolerate this is because energy prices had been falling because the US and Gazprom were offering up more gas. Now, in a world where Gazprom is not a reliable supplier, they are politically compromised, militarily compromised, you know, Germany finds itself in the awkward situation. The only short-term solution for Germany is to burn more coal. So for your green initiative, your energy transition to cost $200-300 billion and actually increase your coal consumption, I don't know how you can measure success and failure, but if something is more expensive and you are consuming more coal and it was a plan that was supposed to make you greener and more environmentally friendly, it's hard to not draw the conclusion that that policy has been a real failure.
Yeah, and just to close on that note, just like here in good old America, ex-politicians and people high up in various powerful agencies go to work for our adversaries and basically sell our country out. So the chancellor prior to Merkel, I can't remember his name, it might be Helmut Schroeder or someone, is actually a lobbyist for Russia. So and he helped secure that first pipeline. Listen, this has been great, Brad. You really covered the waterfront. And I think a lot of the answers to our questions really are important because it gives a lot of our clients that'll hear this a great sense of stability that energy, especially the way you guys look at the world with pipelines, is a much more sustainable income type investment, especially going forward without all the cowboys in the fray spending money like drunken sailors. I will close with my own. I'll close with my own anecdote, and I should have paid more attention to this. In 2014, I was at a financial trade show, and there was a whole bunch of people exhibiting because you know about investing in natural gas and fracking and oil in Texas and you know all the different basins, you know, regardless of where they were located, in Pennsylvania or in North Dakota or there right there in Texas. And this one booth struck me because the guys were they were marketing to invest directly in a private placement. And yet all of the people at the booth were attractive models in mini skirts and cowboy boots, handing out a high brand bourbon in mini bottles that had their name on it. So they paid to have their name on the bourbon bottle. And then you could have a photo taken with the model in her mini skirt and cowboy hat and cowboy boots. And I looked at one of my associates who was traveling with me. I said, if this isn't a sign of the top, you know, let's take the bourbon and get out of here and no more investing in energy. One last question, Brad, do you drink Russian vodka?
No, you know, actually there's nothing like living in Russia to make you not want to ever taste vodka again, because it is at every meal when you're over there.
All right, that's a wrap. All right, man. Have a great day. Say hi to Mark for us.
Will do. Thanks a lot, guys.
Well, thanks, Brad. And if you have any questions or like more information about Recurrent Advisors, you can check out their website, recurrentadvisors.com. And if you have questions for us, as always, reach out, wealthqb.com. My raps are raw. I dribble like a basketball.
Slobber on myself. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to click subscribe. Gordon Asset Management, LLC is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit wealthqb.com. The information in this podcast is presented for edutainment liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast. Its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall...
I ain't paying no attention to the garbage, the plank. Yeah, Dick Chef cooking up another batch for y'all with a side of it. Well done, but I'll wrap some raw.